Well, good evening. Thank you for coming. It's good to have you here. I appreciate it. We are in your book on page 157, and we're getting ready to go through a, for me, it's a difficult time period of history because there's so many things happening, and I hope I can keep this interesting and keep it flowing. We're not going to cover that many years. We're going to kind of cover the Maccabean Revolt. It's about a 3 or 4 year period that the war itself, the revolt was between 168, 165, 164, right in that time period. And then next week we'll kind of pick that up and try and surge forward a little bit more. Well, let me pray and then we'll kind of get introduced to this and get started. Father, we come to you tonight in the name of Jesus, and we do thank you for the chance to be here. We thank you for the history that you've recorded, the faithfulness that you've shown to your people throughout history, and we ask that we may find confidence and trust in you as we look at these things tonight. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. And indeed, that is one of the things that we do find in this story is the faithfulness of God as he continues to work with his people Israel and raising up men like Judas Maccabeus and his brothers and those that were faithful. But the persecution they were under was very intense. Well, let's do this. Let me have you open your Bibles, the book of Daniel. And we look at a few of the prophecies of the Maccabean Revolt in the book of Daniel. We'll spend a little bit of time crunching a few numbers. There's a few verses that have some numbers in it, giving you numbers of some days and things that are kind of interesting. And as always, there's several ways of interpreting these numbers and trying to put them in perspective, from just dismissing them, saying we can never understand it, to, you know, applying them to, you know, today and some kind of cult practices that you can say, well, I must refer to our group and our little church or something like that. But probably they refer to the Maccabean Revolt and some events that take place there. And that's kind of where I'm going to lean towards, and even into the tribulation, some events that may take place in that time. But again, some of the ideas are open to, I don't want to say open to suggestions, but open to interpretation. We're looking in chapter 11 of Daniel. And beginning in verse 20, we're not going to read through all these verses again. We've read up to them talking about the king of the south, which would be the Ptolemies, the king of the north, which would be the Antiochus kings and the Seleucid kings, or Antiochus, depending how we say it. But beginning in verse 21, he will be succeeded by a contemptible person, talking about Seleucid the Third, who replaces Antiochus the Fourth. Or excuse me, Seleucid the Fourth replaces Antiochus the Third. He will be succeeded by a contemptible person. That is Antiochus Epiphanes. And it reads through, talk about the things he does, and we talked about some of those things last week. But it comes all the way, he's persecuting the Jews. He's trying to enforce Hellenism, which is the Greek style of living, which includes education, includes having a gymnasium. There's reports in the book of Josephus that the priest got so involved in this, the priest being the Sadducee group, got so involved in this Hellenistic culture that they forsook the sacrifices and left those things unfinished to get over to the gymnasium to watch and participate in the games. You know, if that sounds like a modern culture right there, I don't know. It's like the athletics were more important. And to become an athlete became very, very prestigious at this time. It is completely foreign to the Jewish culture. Who cared about athletes? Who cared about athletics? It was just a matter of war training to protect your country so you could continue to seek God. But now the Greeks have flip-flopped it, brought it in, and they're going, this is fun. And so they're pursuing these athletic events. Of course, I'm a coach and I'm an athlete, so I'm not ripping on athletics. But you can just see how this culture is just really being twisted by the Hellenization. That's just a little bit of the introduction to it. But anyway, he begins to persecute the Jews at different times. We're going to go back and review this and put it in a historical setting. But he began to realize that if these people, the Jews, do not come over to his side and they remain Jewish and with their culture, he's going to lose ground. He's going to lose a position against the empire of the Ptolemies or the kingdom of the Ptolemies. Rome is coming over, so he needs the Jews on his side. He's eventually going to get rid of his tolerance position and have a non-tolerant stance. Complete conformity, where everyone has to worship his gods, everyone has to follow the Hellenistic ways, meaning they've got to forsake the covenant. They're burning the Torah, will eventually be burning the Torah tonight, or the scriptures. They can no longer circumcise their children, and if you do, there is persecution for it, including the killing of mothers. They are at different times
people that have stood with the, we'll say, the Pharisee group. And of course, in the New Testament, the Pharisees are part of the problem. But again, they became part of the problem in degrees. You know, at this time, they're the ones holding to the law, trying to stay pure and hold to the covenant of God. Again, there's all kinds. We're going to introduce all these groups here again in just a moment. But the Pharisees, in a process of degrees, they became corrupt and became self-serving. And as you see in the New Testament, they became a problem for John the Baptist and Jesus. But if you were in a group that was trying to hold to the covenant, there are situations, many are recorded, of people being filleted alive by Antiochus Epiphanes' people as they saw them as resistors and they wouldn't cooperate. And they were being killed and burnt and persecuted like the early church or even the church throughout time. And so again, the things that are taking place here are flat out wicked that he's doing to the Jewish people. First socially, but then eventually physically persecuting to them. But nonetheless, what I really got into the book of Romans or book of Daniel here, in verse 31, say, his armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress. And it's interesting that it's called temple fortress because it is talking about the Jewish temple. But right there on the north side of the Temple Mount, northwest corner, is the fortress, or the Acra, A-C-R-A is what it was called. By the time Herod gets there and rebuilds it and renames it, it's Fort Antonia, or Antonius, named after Mark Antony. And that is where Jesus was tried, at Fort Antonia. But at this time, it is an older version of it. But the temple fortress, troops will be stationed there. Syrian troops will be stationed there. And will abolish the daily sacrifice. Then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. We'll talk about this here again later. With flattery, he'll corrupt those who have violated the covenant. In other words, he'll flatter them, come over to my side, and he needs them for military support, financial support, political support, as a physical base of operation to invade Egypt. He needs, so he'll flatter them, get rid of this covenant, come over to my side. Whatever it takes, I'll give it to you. But the people who know their God will firmly resist him. And that's what we're getting ready to see here, is this Maccabean revolt. It's going to become so wicked, so terrible. And you watch this, you can see it even as we've been going. You've seen the process, the slide. And you wonder, how long are they going to put up with this? And some people are against it. They're not supporting it. But eventually, the people have to respond or just give away their culture. And now it's going to depend on how enriched is their culture? How entrenched is their culture in them? How serious are they about it? Is it just a way of life, or has this got eternal consequences? And for some people, they saw it as having eternal consequences, and they ended up revolting from a... Well, let's read on. Those who are wise will instruct many. In other words, do not go this way. Stay away from the Hellenization. This is not something we want to get involved in. It's going to come back and bite you. And indeed, even those who were on the Hellenistic side, we're going to find out as they got into it, this wasn't what we signed up for. We thought we were going to have games and have some Greek-style clothes, maybe read a few Greek plays or something and visit the theater. We did not know it was going to get to this extent. And again, the wise were warning them, saying, do not side of this. And it's been coming now since the days of Alexander the Great. It's been creeping in on them. And some are going, this is great. I think we got a little bit of prosperity here. This is giving us a chance for peace and, you know, some fun things in life. But as it gets worse and worse, they begin to realize this has got the bite of a snake to it. Though for a time they'll fall by the sword or be burned, and they were, or captured, and they were, thousands at a time were captured and sold at different times that they're being invaded, or plundered. When they fall, now here I think is the Maccabean, and most commentators would agree with this, when they fall, they'll receive a little help. And many who are not sincere will join them. In other words, the Maccabees were sincere. There was nothing to gain politically for them. There's everything to lose, including their lives and their well-being. And they stood up and fought. But what began to happen was many who were not sincere, who were politically involved, or just had some political or financial gain to be made, as the Maccabees began to increase, it's like, oh yeah, well, we're over here on the side of the covenant too. And they're going to see this swing. Again, it's a typical thing that you see in religion or Christianity, is when religion is persecuted is when it begins to grow and become strong. As it becomes strong and gains some momentum, others look at it and go, whoa, This is a good place to advertise. This is a good place to market. And you know, as soon as a church begins to grow and get some numbers, all of a sudden here comes people in using it as a chance to get involved with business connections. You know, so far my churches haven't been a problem with that. They haven't been big enough to have great business connections. When they fall, they'll receive a little help, and many who are not sincere will join them. Some of the wise will stumble, so that they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. And so that's kind of the verse that we're looking at right here. We're going to come back to the book of Daniel here in a little bit and look at some numbers because it's just going to pop up and it's interesting. But I want to mention this too. To understand the situation in Jerusalem at this time, there's a lot of things happening. There's a lot of tension. These are just a few of the groups. Some of them you're going to be familiar with. The Pharisees, we've talked about them. They're the group that were the ones that were keeping the law. They're the ones that were studying the law, the scribes, the teachers of the law, and that kind of countered the Sadducees. Again, the word Sadducees comes from the word Zadok, or the Zadokites. In the Greek, you see it better in the Greek. But they're the ones that were claimed descent or a religious connection to the priest that David appointed, Zadok the priest, and so they are the priests. These guys were very easily pulled over to Hellenism, or the Greek way of life. They were into the finances, they were into the money, they were into politics. So the Pharisees, and again, they're going to drift as they go. The Sadducees were already, I think, corrupt. But there's going to be another group called the Essenes that is going to emerge out of this. And this is basically the people group. There's many priests that join them. But these are those that saw the Pharisees becoming politically active, saw the Sadducees already being politically active after the power. And the Essenes are going, where's the truth? Where's God in all this? And they eventually just pull out of Jerusalem and end up in the wilderness and different places. John the Baptist may come from this group of the Essenes. It's a pretty good bet. Of course, they're not mentioned in the Bible because they didn't really come in contact with Jesus in the New Testament. But the Essenes are the people who kind of drift away. Now, in all of this, these guys become very violent enemies. You've got Egypt and Syria. Remember, Judah or Israel has been bounced back and forth between the Ptolemies and Antiochus up north. And so what you see right there is when they're controlled by Syria, some people say, oh, this is good, and we like Syria. Then all of a sudden Egypt comes, and then maybe their financial situation changes, and Egypt has got more power and authority, or they're being occupied by Egypt, and they'd be against Egypt, or vice versa. So within the city of Jerusalem, we're talking just Jews. Some are of the covenant. Some are of the Hellenistic culture, maybe lined up with the priests. Others are drifting away going, this is all getting crazy. Others are saying we're pro-Egypt. Others are pro-Syria. They may be part of the Sadducees and be pro-Syria. Eventually there's going to be another group emerge out of this, the Herodians. You remember in the New Testament, the Herodians, who are going to be pro-Herod, because in that sense, they're pro-Roman. They say, well, our advantage is to be with Rome and Herod, and so they supported Herod, but of course that's not on the map yet. And then you remember from last week, Joseph. Onias' brother, Tobias, had a son named Joseph, who went down to Ptolemy and got permission to collect taxes. Joseph now is collecting taxes. He's got seven sons, and they help him collect taxes. And then he's got another son with an extra wife named Hyrcanus, who goes down to Ptolemy and gets permission to collect taxes on the other side of the Jordan. So now you've got those who support Joseph and his tax collecting group, and those who support Hyrcanus and his tax collecting group. But sometimes the Sadducees or the priests will support Joseph, and now you've got the Joseph people lined up with the Sadducees, but then a new high priest comes in and he switches and says, no, I'm supporting Hyrcanus. Hyrcanus, bring your money and keep it stored here in the temple. Well, now that switched. So you understand, Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes, some are political Egypt or Syria lined up, some are supporting Joseph or Hyrcanus, and the mixture becomes great. And we haven't even gotten into this right here, when the high priesthood, Jason, whose name is Joshua, goes up and buys the high priesthood from Antiochus Epiphanes, and he becomes the leader of the temple and begins to support Antiochus until his Menelaus comes up and offers 300 more talents. Jason bought it for 440, Menelaus for 300 talents. And Menelaus now comes down and says, Jason, you're done. I'm now the high priest. Well, so Jason's upset. But the people who support Jason are upset, and they begin to fight against Menelaus and say, you can't take the priesthood. So now you've got Jews fighting Jews over the priesthood. Menelaus goes up to Antiochus and says, I need help. He says, well, I need more money. He's okay, here's more money. Send me some army. So then Menelaus is going to be given an escort to come down and attack Jerusalem, to get the Jason driven out and take over the priesthood. And now we've got the fighting going on here, and this isn't going to go away. Jason's people go into retreat, while Menelaus plunders the temple because he gave Antiochus a ton of money for the priesthood, and the royal escort come down and take over the priesthood. So what's he going to do to pay his debt? Well, he's going to go into the temple and start selling stuff. He's going to start selling stuff to Tyre, the vessels and the golden objects to Tyre, to help pay for his debt that he gave to Antiochus to get the priesthood. Well, now Jason's people are upset. Many of the, you can imagine the Pharisees are going nuts over this. Some of the Sadducees and the priests support Jason, some support Menelaus. I mean, things are just getting completely bound up. So eventually, there's going to be tremendous strife within Jerusalem. And we're not just talking the Syrians versus the Jews. We're talking the Syrians are looking at this and saying, who's on our side? And this is all mixed together. They're killing, if Syria would just pull out, they'd kill each other. And this is eventually going to lead to Rome coming in another century, coming in and looking at it going, what? And of course, Rome likes order and they don't like this. And Rome says, forget it. We're going to start all over. We are all your enemies. And they just take control of this and they put Herod on the throne. They say, we don't like Herod. We don't like anybody. I mean, if we put anybody on the throne, if we put in a Sadducee, the Pharisees will kill him. If we put someone from Menelaus, the Essenes will get upset. So we'll just put Herod. He's a foreigner. He's your king. Get used to it. And then they united. We all hate Herod. Until finally a group of the Herodians say, we like Rome, and then the whole thing started. And Jesus is going to walk into this mess and say, or John the Baptist, and say, the kingdom is coming. And it's like, can you imagine, you understand the confusion? I mean, we can blame Democrats and Republicans. You know, we just got two groups. And you probably break this down more. But understand, that's I think kind of interesting. And again, that's what makes this whole story difficult to tell, because you can talk about an event and you can just put it in two groups. Well, this is Antiochus Epiphanes invading Jerusalem, but when he gets there, there's already 12 groups fighting with each other, plus Egypt is on the side and Rome is coming. Okay.
Is Antiochus Syrian?
Yes, he's the king of the north.
And so how did Herod, the Roman Empire, take over Syria?
Right, Rome is still coming. Rome is in the Macedonian Wars right now. That's a good question. Just real quickly, I don't want to raise these names yet. These are the Maccabean boys. Here's very quickly a map. Here's Greece over here. This is Asia Minor, Jerusalem, Egypt. Antiochus, or Antiochus Epiphanes, is king of the north up here, going all the way to Babylon. Ptolemies are the kings down here. Originally, to understand Rome, again, I simplify it, is they're just kind of interested in their own little place there in Italy. They're happy Romans, there we go. But they start getting invaded from the north and the south. It's like, hey, don't mess with us. So then they conquer these people, says, now leave us alone. Well, now they occupy this territory, and then someone from next to them invades. It's like, well, hey, and they had to go, they just kind of keep reaching out. And at this time, they are actually over here in Macedonia, fighting Macedonia, because they got involved with the Macedonian situation. It's like, what do we do now? We just can't walk away. If we walk away, send some troops in. You ever heard that before? Send more troops. And they sent more troops. And now they're fighting the Macedonian. Rome has no intention of conquering Jerusalem. Not at this point.
So then who made Herod the king?
Rome did.
Yeah.
But that's going to be 63... let me think this real quickly. 63 B.C., Rome takes Jerusalem. Because of this chaos here, the people of Jerusalem are going to say to Romans, here, why don't you just make us a province and tax us? And the tax they enforced on Jerusalem at that time is way less than the tax we pay our own government. But that's another sermon for another time. But anyway, they said, fine, just come in and occupy us in 63 B.C., And Rome tried to appoint some governors and try to work with the groups that were there, including the Hasmoneans that we're going to talk about here. But it ends up being so chaotic that they bring in a man from Idumea, the Edomites. It'd be Herod's father, Antipater. And make him the governor of the area under Roman province. They think, okay, if you really want to know, in Galilee, Herod is like a 22-year-old kid. And because his father is in charge of Judea and this area for the Romans, they end up giving Herod permission to control Galilee. It's a war zone, not a war zone. It's filled with bandits and criminals. gangs, if you would. And Herod just goes in there and just, you know, it's like coming to the Wild West, just shuts it down, says, you know, there's a new sheriff in town, and subdues this by force, makes it prosperous. When his father dies, Rome likes Herod, and they say, well, can we have you work down here too? Now, right about there, Rome's got a civil war. I've got to go back, okay? I'm too far in the history right in the future. Rome is going to have a civil war. Octavian, Caesar Augustus, but Octavian, before he became Caesar Augustus, is fighting against Mark Antony. And Herod had been friends with Mark Antony when he was being educated in Rome. And so when Mark Antony goes to war against Octavian, Herod sides with Mark Antony. Well, Mark Antony loses the civil war, and Octavian becomes emperor. And the Senate decides, we're going to call you Augustus, Caesar Augustus, the exalted Caesar. And he accepts the title. And he calls for Herod, says, okay, time for judgment. Come, Herod, why did you fight against me? And Herod, I mean, no matter how you read the scriptures, I mean, we've got the story of the Bethlehem babies, but Herod was brilliant. I mean, he was a great leader. He comes to Caesar Augustus in Rome, who had just won the Civil War, ruling the Roman Empire, and explain yourself. He says, well, he says, I was a friend of Mark Antony. I was faithful to him throughout the war. He says, now, if you will accept me as your friend, I will be as faithful to you as I was to Mark Antony. And Octavian, or Caesar Augustus, says, good answer. And sent him back with more territory than he had, and he became appointed with the title at that time, for the first time, the title, King of the Jews under the Roman Empire. And I think that was 40 B.C., Now, Herod doesn't get into Jerusalem to sit on his throne until 37 B.C. Why? It took him 3 years of war to get to his city where he was king of, because the Jews were fighting him. So nonetheless, Herod becomes king of the Jews in 40 B.C., enters Jerusalem, and sits on his throne in 37 B.C. as king of the Jews, having been appointed by Octavian, who had just won the civil war against Mark Antony, who had Rome had previously appointed Antipater, Herod's father, to be a proconsul or governor of Judea in that area. Herod basically just proved himself as being very, very effective, and for the next 40 years did a tremendous, tremendous job of ruling this land. So that's where Herod comes from. That's in the future. Rome, tonight in our story, is in the middle of one of the Macedonian wars, with just north of Greece up here, fighting here. Remember, Antiochus Antiochus III had gone over and engaged Rome in battle and was defeated, and has been spending these last years, him and his successors, paying the debt. Antiochus Epiphanes, and tonight, if we tell the story right, will eventually have paid that war debt off back to Rome, because they'll fight a war and then they'll charge the loser. And so that is why all this money in the temple is such a big deal, because they're just filtering it from the temple to the Syrians over to pay the Romans for the debt of the war they had. So Rome is here, but that because they win this war, they're going to get some oppression from here, so they're going to send in some troops. And they send in troops, and by 63 B.C., they're down here, and they say, they didn't even want Judea. Judea came to Rome and says, take us and make us a province. And the Senate debated it. It's kind of like, it's been a mess for a long time. We just want to stay on the outside and watch. But they say, please take over. We'll pay you this. And they say, all right. And so Rome made them a province. And, of course, then they all started fighting. And then we'd get down to Herod. Does that help you at all? Is that... Okay. That's again the simplified version. Yeah, it's in the book. Okay. What we got off on here was all these political groups, both political, including taxation, including the high priesthood, who's on whose side, and it's just they're just fighting continuously. Now, these are the guys we're heading towards right here. I should start telling the story here and get into this, but Mattathias is going to be a priest, an aged priest. Some say he was 145 years old, and because it's not a scriptural recording, I'm going to say 145 years old is a pretty old guy. But he was nonetheless an old guy. I'm not going to criticize Josephus or the Maccabee. Maybe he was that old. But anyway, he was an old man. He comes from a family of priests known as the Asmoneus, or there's a man named Asmoneus, and it becomes known through in history now as the Hasmoneans. Now, this is kind of stuff that if you read books and stuff, it's like, well, who are the Hasmoneans? They're the Maccabees. They come from the family of priests called the Asmoneans. Mattathias has got five sons, Judas, Simon, Eleazar, Jonathan, and John. These are his five sons. Judas is going to be the military leader. Some would say he's a military genius. And there's no doubt about it. You can read the history. He is going to, by the time we get done tonight, if I get there, he is going to bring the Syrian Empire or kingdom up here to its knees. He is going to eventually go to Rome and have a treaty, sign a treaty with the coming Roman Empire. And he, at this time, is living in a small village. We know generally where it's at, but it's never been excavated. We can't find it. It's such an insignificant village. You understand what I'm saying? We can find Capernaum and Bethesda and, Jezreel. We can find Gezer. We can find all kinds of cities and excavate the walls and date things. But Modin, we can find Nazareth and Bethlehem. But we don't know where Modin is. It's in this general area. But there's nothing left of it. And so that is how, in a sense, insignificant this guy was. And he was just one of five brothers. But he comes out of this revolt as a military genius and fights several battles. Again, he's got, just like that verse said, now again, we don't want to discount prophecy, the Jews will receive a little help. And this, I think, is that little help it's referring to. Simon, as the story goes, was his counselor. And Judas was the military mind. Simon was the wisdom behind it. Like, this is what we should do, and giving advice. And these guys are all going to play parts in it. Judas is going to die. John is going to die. These sons are going to move on, and they're going to eventually become, because they're priests, when they come back and clean the temple and set it back up, they're going to take over the position of high priest. But remember the political situation. There's not a clear distinction between the political group and the priestly group and even the prophetic or religious group. By this time, it's just the biggest dog in the park controls it all. Prophet, priest, and king. Now, the prophet, priest, and king that we look for in Scripture, of course, is Jesus Christ. He is the prophet. He's the one who came and told us what was going to take place. He is the king, the soon coming king. He came as the king. And he is our high priest. So Jesus is the ultimate fulfillment of this. But in these days right here, it's interesting that God had set up in the Old Testament of three different forms of power. The prophet, the priest, and the king. You can even see within there the balance. And you read the Bible account in the Old Testament, which you went through. When the king would begin to err, the prophet could come over and correct him. And the good king would go, well, thank you, prophet. I was wrong. And come back in line. The prophet didn't have any power in civil matters, but he could tell the king what God was thinking. And the king would have civil powers. But remember when the king tried to come into the temple, Uzziah, leprosy broke out. You don't come in here. You don't belong here. This is the priest territory. In other words, you see that checks and balance even within there. And God had his country, his people set up with this. By this time, because of, again, humanity and how things work, the high priest, even in our as we begin our story, had all these lists, the Sadducees, the high priest is very powerful. He controls a lot of money. He's way outside the temple. And these guys, when they become priests, they're going to have other sons, and they're going to have like several generations. These high priests are going to become the king, in a sense, the civil leader. And many of these high priests are going to lead wars against other nations and win and conquer cities and slaughter people and to advance their own country. So again, the Hasmoneans or the Maccabees are going to be this group, and they're going to continue to come on down to the line of Herod. And again, since we mentioned Herod, one of the things Herod does is marry one of the great-great-great-granddaughters of the Hasmonean family, Mariam, marry her to kind of help, you know, bring him in line with the Jewish people. Hey, I've married into your royal line. And then he kills her. And her sons, and anybody that was related to the Hasmoneans, because they didn't do what he wanted. So he was a great guy, I guess, but, you know. Now, another name out of this, Judas, we know him as Judas Maccabeus. It's as far as I can tell, it's not really a name. It's not really, where did that name come from? The name came from his ability to strike so quickly. It means the hammer. And he became known to the Syrians and the people that fought with him as Judas the Hammer, which translated backwards is Judas Maccabeus. And so the Maccabees, or Judas Maccabeus, it was a reference to him and his military ability, but it became, in a sense, the last name, Simon Maccabeus, Eleazar Maccabeus, or the Maccabees, the Maccabean Revolt. But in a sense, they're really their last name is from this family line, or the Hasmoneans. Does that help you at all in any of that? Okay? Let's leave it on the board for a little bit, and let's look in the book. Okay. Boy, how do we begin this? We are in the year, well, look on page 157. We are in the year 172. And we've already talked about some of these things. We're going to back up and take a running start at it. In 172, Joshua, who was the high priest, who bought the high priesthood from Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, I don't mind you asking questions. Because if I say, if I'm saying Antiochus Epiphanes, and you're thinking, who's that guy? I'm about to shoot a bunch of other names at you. Please, it may even be good for me to slow down. So up here, Antiochus Epiphanes. He is now the king of the north. Antiochus, or Antiochus the IV. Down here we've got a series of Ptolemies, including a man who marries a lady named Cleopatra, who is Antiochus' sister. Okay, so when Ptolemy has children, they're going to be the nephews of Antiochus. So in other words, eventually Ptolemy, I think it's like the sixth, I can't remember exactly who it is. But one of the Ptolemies he's going to be dealing with tonight, Antiochus, is going to be his nephew, and this is Uncle Antiochus. Now, Epiphanes means the enlightened one, or the illustrious one. In a sense, he calls himself God. I am God. I am the one. Because of the way he behaved, they changed his name, both his troops and the Jews, Epimenes, which, that's really funny, because Epimenes means the madman. Antiochus the IV, or Antiochus Epimenes, he calls himself Antiochus Epiphanes. They called him Antiochus, or Antiochus Epimenes. That would be his reference, or they probably call him. The Bible calls him a contemptible person. Remember that verse there. But anyway, down here in Jerusalem, we have the high priest who's bought his position. His name is Joshua. He switched his name to Jason. Sends Menelaus up with his tribute. And that's where we're at, 172 on page 157. Sends him his tribute. But Menelaus, when he gets there, says, I'll give you 300 extra, or a total of 750 talents, if you'll let me be high priest. And Antiochus Epiphanes says, okay, you're the high priest. So Menelaus comes down. And, of course, Jerusalem says, you can't do that. So he has to return to Antioch and say, they won't let me in the town. And so Antiochus says, well, I'm going to need some more money if I'm going to send troops. Okay, I guarantee you this much money. Troops are sent. Menelaus come down. Now, this is a man, a Jewish man. He now attacks Jerusalem and drives out Jason, who leaves and goes over to the other side of the Jordan. Drives Jason, who is, and he's like, oh, don't you feel sorry for Jason? No, Jason bought the priesthood from Antiochus the first time and sent Onias the third, a good high priest, to prison. That's where he was taken. So now, as you read the story, one of the hard things about reading the story is, who are you cheering for? Menelaus is attacking Jerusalem against Jason, and Jason is defeated. And it's like, I didn't want either one of them to win. But now Menelaus is the high priest in Jerusalem, and he has access to the temple. The first thing he does is, you can read it here, he goes into the temple and starts taking out vessels. This is going to be one of several times the temple is plundered. The temple must have a tremendous amount of wealth in there, and we know it does.
So these vessels, and the vessels, some of the vessels, just so you understand this, some of the vessels that he's taking are things that were sent back from Babylon by Cyrus, that were taken by Nebuchadnezzar out of Solomon's temple, that have been there since the days of Solomon. So some of the vessels, Menelaus, if you want to hate this guy, and it's going to be easy to, some of the things that Menelaus is selling up here in the market in Tyre are some of the vessels Solomon's people made in the original temple that apparently went to Babylon, came back, and they've been there preserved. And he says, hey, this will bring some good cash. I can pay Antiochus this money. Now, if you're interested in this historically, it is interesting, but all of this is a foreshadowing of a day yet to come. And we'll get to that in a minute. Okay. Onias, the third, there it says right here, the true high priest who's in prison because he went up to get help from the Syrians, and Jerusalem is in chaos, we need help. When he got up there, they just put him in prison. And Jason became the high priest. He protests Menelaus' behavior from prison, and he is executed. Antiochus orders him to be executed. Well, okay, now 170 to 168. This is where we kind of left off last week. Maybe you don't feel like we're getting anywhere. I'm sorry. There are six Syrian wars. And now we're going to come down here and fight against the Ptolemies again. And so here comes Antiochus the 50th. He's going to invade Egypt. Menelaus is the high priest right here. Antiochus Epiphanes is successful, and the two regents who lead Egypt for the very young king Ptolemy the VI are killed. So and Ptolemy the VI is the young king. He's too young to rule, and his uncle has just invaded his country, killed his substitute leaders. Antiochus Epiphanes actually takes the young Ptolemy, who's his nephew, into his own guardianship and says, I'll take care of the young boy myself, trust me. And he's already killed other people to get this position here. Which now gives Antiochus control of Egypt. Now, Rome doesn't like that. In the matter of the fact that Rome is fighting these wars, they're getting grain to feed their soldiers. Part of their supply line is coming from Egypt. So Rome, although they can't come down and fight Antiochus, they can say, you know, back off a little bit. That's what they're going to do. And when this takes place, Alexander Egypt revolts against him. We go to the next page, page 158. And there is a good description there, or not a good description, some things I put down of Hellenism, of what is taking place in Jerusalem. And it's going to intensify. It's trying to bring Greek culture in, as you know, but it's going to eventually be the place where it's actually not just tolerant. Now, here's a little heads up. It's not going to be just tolerant. Hellenism and the Jewish law cannot survive together. They conflict with each other. And for a while, you can play the game, but eventually, one of them has to break. And we're going to see as this develops here, Hellenism eventually says, we need to stamp out Judaism, or the covenant. And you can see this is kind of like the early stages of it. In 169, we have to do this. Let me go back. I got to keep this straight here. When Menelaus is here, and here Antiochus has come down here, Menelaus is in Jerusalem. And a war breaks out. He's already taken control. But they revolt against Menelaus, the Jews, because they don't like him. And he has to flee to the fortress. And the fortress is just on the north side of the temple, like I said. He flees there to get protection from the people. And the people take over Jerusalem, whatever the people are. I mean, whatever group they're in. It's like, you don't know if you should cheer for them again or not, because they're Jason's people, they're the Sadducees, however that's going. Antiochus comes back up from having defeated Ptolemy the VI, having things under control here. He comes back up here and attacks and gets Menelaus out of the aqueduct, gets him out of the garrison, the fortress, I mean. And Menelaus then takes, and this is in 169, 170, Menelaus then takes Antiochus into the temple and into the holy place. And that is now he's desecrated the holy place. And the Jews now hate him even more. They hate Menelaus even worse. During this time, a revolt breaks down out here in Egypt. While he's there, Menelaus and Antiochus, they make the law illegal. Circumcision is illegal. They're oppressing the Jews. And Antiochus has to return to put down this revolt. When he gets here and he wins this first battle and then pursues deeper into Egypt, word comes back up here to Jerusalem that Antiochus has been killed.
And so now we're pushing on the year 168, 169, 169, 168 here. Okay, this is the third time. I left this off last week. Rome shows up to talk that, you know, get grain, and they send a decree from the Senate, and they tell Antiochus to leave Egypt. And he says, well, I don't know if I'm going to do that or not. And the general, or the senator who's down there, draws a circle around Antiochus in the sand there and says, you tell me before you leave the circle. And of course, he's got no other hope. Word is back here that Antiochus has been killed. And of course, now the revolt breaks out again. They think they've got their chance to take over. And when he returns up here, Antiochus is furious. He realizes he's got to completely conform Jerusalem. And this is where the serious persecution actually breaks out. And we would be in 168. Let's go, if you don't mind, page 159 at the top. Here we go. The Roman Senate, being interested in their supply of grain from Egypt, sends Gaius Popilius Linnaeus to Alexandria. And this is someone that Antiochus knew from his time in Rome. Remember, Antiochus had been a prisoner in Rome earlier because of the Roman debt. So he knows this guy, and that's where he draws a circle around him. I already told you that. Now, in December, Antiochus hears the report that Jerusalem is in revolt against Hellenism and Menelaus. Antiochus arrives in Jerusalem and begins to punish the Jews and saves Menelaus. And this punishment now in Jerusalem, this is his third time to come here, but this time it's a severe. He now forgets any kind of a tolerance policy, and everyone has to convert. Homes are looted and burnt. Thousands of women and children are sold into slavery. 22,000 soldiers attack and are stationed in the garrison. I believe at this time there was 40,000 men were killed in 3 days. 40,000 more were sold into slavery. And Antiochus brings in not a handful of soldiers, but imagine 22,000 Syrian soldiers move into Jerusalem and they're placed in the garrison in the temple. If you don't mind, just so I can do, go to... I don't know if I got a good map of it or not. Go to the very back pages, if you don't mind. Any one of those pages there that's got a... I know a good page. Let me find it here. We'll go to Jesus' trial. Let me go to the New Testament quickly. You can flip over right around page... right on page 200. 200 and... yeah, like 205. I appreciate your patience here. This is a map of... page 205 is a map of Jerusalem the way it would have looked in 30 A.D. And this would be Monday or Sunday. Any of those days would be fine. It's all the same map. But you can see the temple there. It says outer court, inner court. You know where I'm at? I'm on page 205. And then if you look just right above the word outer, you can see that little square box. And it says Fort Antoni up there kind of toward the top left of that little box. It's got six little square boxes in it. That's the depiction of Fort Antoni. That is where the Acra is at. And that's important to understand that, because you can see where the Temple Mount is at, where the temple is facing east. And now Antiochus places 22,000 soldiers in that general area, and they're stationed there in the garrison. Of course, they're going to be throughout the city, but that is their base of operation. Menelaus had been driven into that for a while. He's going to be driven into that again. That's going to become a problem. Even after Judas Maccabeus takes the city of Jerusalem, there's still going to be a stronghold in the Acra, that it's called the Acra this time, and they can't get into them. And they've got supplies that they're living on. And while Judas is purifying the temple in 164 B.C., getting it cleansed after Antiochus Epiphanes desecrated it, they're still shooting arrows from the Acra down at the workers in the temple area, because they can't get in to get them out, and they won't come out. That's how strong a fortress it is. So what Judas ends up doing is building a wicker wall to protect the temple area so they can work and the priests can serve without getting shot with arrows from the Acra. So anyway, that's just so you kind of know, that's when I say the fortress. And the 22,000 soldiers are stationed in there to help Menelaus. Okay, we're back on page 159. Is that making sense at all? Am I keeping Okay. I mean, we're talking about three different empires and 18 different political groups. And
And we're trying to
do the Maccabean Revolt. We haven't even talked about it yet.
I know.
So do I. We're tired of this. We're about there. Anyway, we're on 5th bullet point down in 168. Homes are looted and burnt. Thousands of women and children are sold into slavery. 22,000 soldiers attack and are stationed in the garrison in Jerusalem. Menelaus then leads Antiochus Epiphanes into the temple. Together, the two plunder it and desecrate it. They're going to take out now, not the vessels, but they now take out, if you can imagine this, they take out the lampstands, they take out the tables, they take out the golden altar of incense up by the curtain. They take it out and they get rid of them. They want to get them sold. On December 25th, and this is the year 168, on December 25th, this is the official day that they desecrated the temple. An altar to Zeus, some would say Jupiter, is built and replaces the altar of burnt offerings. In other words, on the altar of burnt offerings, it's a fairly big altar. I'm going to draw a big square. It's not as big as the Mediterranean Sea here, but it's big. They don't necessarily remove it and take it out. They build on top of it, or they place on top of it, an idol altar. It's got an image of the god, Jupiter or Zeus, and a place to offer a pig on it. So on the altar, they put another altar to worship the Greek god. And they offer a pig, and they take the pig, and they boil it, and get the broth or the stew or whatever from it. And with that stew or the blood of the pig, they go around the whole temple precinct and just splatter it. In other words, they're completely defiling the temple for the Jews. And they are going to begin offering sacrifices to the Greek gods on God's altar with this pagan altar sitting on top of it. And that is December 25th, 168. Now, just so you know where this is heading, in 165, December 25th, 3 years later is the day Judas takes it back in December. They spend several weeks cleaning it. I talked about how they're shooting arrows at it. Judas takes it back. But in 165, on December 5th, exactly 3 years later, they have the temple re-cleaned or rededicated and begin sacrificing again. So it's going to be that three-year period right there. We'll talk about that as we get going. The Jews are then forced to worship the image by offering swine flesh to the statue of Zeus. And some would say it was Zeus's body on the image, but it was definitely Antiochus Epiphanes' face. So it's like they're offering swine flesh on God's altar to this guy right here, who's dressed himself up like he's Zeus or Jupiter or someone. 167. Menelaus is restored as the high priest because there'd been a revolt. Soldiers forced Jews to build altars and make sacrifices to Zeus and worship Antiochus Epiphanes. Torahs are burnt. Circumcision is forbidden. And violators are tortured. And indeed, they are tortured if they do this. Now, one of the things that they do is they are now in a complete, the Syrians, Antiochus' men, are in complete attempt to try and conform all the Jews. They're going to stamp out the covenant. And so they go throughout the land of Israel. Here's a bigger map. Here's Galilee, Jordan, Dead Sea. Here's Jerusalem. And if you look there, you can see Modin. I got it right about here. When we landed in Tel Aviv, and we drove, this is my first time in Jerusalem or Israel, and we drove a 45-minute drive into Jerusalem. And I'm looking out the window, and there's two elderly Jewish people there. And they, after about 5 minutes of being in the van, the taxi, we're driving several people, they lean over, they go, "Is this your first time in Israel?" It's like, "Yeah. How did you tell?" Because you're taking pictures in the dark, there's nothing to see. But no, but I remember one of the first things I remember seeing as I go by here was a sign that said Modin on it. And it had the burial places of the Maccabees, and it had some tributes and stuff for the Maccabees. And again, like I said, they don't know where it actually is at, but again, they've got the general area there. But nonetheless, you can see on the map on page 160 the city of Modin, and also notice the hills of Gophna right here, just to the north. Again, when I say we don't know where it's at, this is good enough. We do know where it's at. It's right here. Now, I'd actually go over there and say, this is the city we don't know, but it's not up here, over here, over here. It's right there. So anyway, here we go. What they were doing, the guy's name is Apelles. He is one of the guys that is sent out by Antiochus, and there's several of them that are sent out. But they are sent out as a governor, and they're sent out with a handful of troops, and a like a totem pole, if you would, or an image of Zeus and a pig. And they go to these different communities, find a leading citizen, have them offer the swine to the Greek gods, and everything's fine. You can continue with your lives. You have now come over. It's like baptism. It's like John the Baptist asking the Jews to come down here and get baptized as a sign of repentance, that you are repenting of your stance. And you're good. You're in right standing. You've made it. You made a commitment. And that's all they're asking for, is a commitment. Well, they come to Modin. And Mattathias, they find Mattathias. He's the elder priest there. And they say, Mattathias, the whole town's ordered to come out to this community center. And they have the pig there. They have the altar there with the little totem pole. They have the little hatchet or axe that they use to butcher the pig or kill the pig with. And they say, Mattathias, would you do this? And he basically says, no. I mean, and they realize that he gets kind of mouthy with them. I don't know if I've got it written down in here. But he says it in such a way. I'm trying to see if I got it written down. I don't have time to read it. But anyway, he says no. And a young man, an apostate Jew, comes out of the crowd and says, I will do it for the community. Well, Mattathias isn't going to put up with that. So, again, the old man grabs the axe, kills the apostate Jew, and then turns and kills Apelles, the senior officer there. His boys then jump the other guards and soldiers there and kill them, and now they've got a bunch of dead bodies laying around of the Syrian soldiers of Antiochus Epiphanes, who thinks he's God. And they realize, we've just crossed the line. And so we can see right here at the bottom of that page, it says, Mattathias says, let everyone who is zealous for the law and who stands by the covenant follow me. That's how Josephus records it. He says, we are in revolt, we're not turning back. And it got so bad that, I mean, you'd think that they would have done something earlier, but things got so bad that they finally took action. And they have to flee now to the hills of Gophna. You can see right there, the hills of Gophna. They have to leave all their possessions behind and go up here to Gophna. And in the hills, they stay, they're like a guerrilla group, if you would. They don't have any organized, you know, plans, although Judas is developing that as they're going. And what they do, they go out at night and they attack villages. And they find people who are faithful to the Syrians and attack them. They find places of altars that are set up to Zeus or Antiochus, knock them over. They find people that have not circumcised their babies, circumcise the babies. They are fighting for the law of God, and they're fighting any kind of the Syrian soldiers they find. They will attack them, leave the dead bodies, and take the weapons. Well, it's nothing. I mean, you get a picture of how small this is. It's an old man with five sons and a little bit of a following, and they're making a stance. It's an amazing story. Now, on page 161, the Maccabean revolt begins and gains support of the Hasidim. Now, the Hasidim is a group I haven't mentioned to you, but the Hasidim has, I don't know if I can spell it right, it's right there in the book. The Hasidim are the pure ones. That's another old group, and they would follow the law similar to the Pharisees. But what they have had trouble with is they have been being attacked by the Syrians. I haven't said this yet. But whenever the Syrians and Antiochus Epiphanes would attack Jerusalem, guess what day they would attack them? Saturday, the Sabbath. They would attack, and it's like, and the Jews, to be faithful to the law, would be like, gotta die today. And they would just be like sheep being slaughtered because they are so faithful to the covenant. One of the first things Judas Maccabeus does is he makes a law, and he says, from now on, then the Hasidim had a bunch of their people slaughtered. They go, we don't know what to do. We can be prepared for war all we want to, and then they show up on the Sabbath, and we just got to stand there and get killed. And Judas says, I don't think that's smart. I don't think that's the intent of the law. And if it is, I'm going to violate it, he says. He didn't say it that way, but it's kind of like his attitude. He's like, I think we've got to fight for ourselves and our families, even on the Sabbath. And so that was really a turning point in this revolt, because up until this time, they could revolt, prepare, and do all they wanted to, but when it came to Sabbath, they couldn't move. They were paralyzed. When he began to fight and the Hasidim began to fight, things began to change. The Hasidim now joined Judas in 167. They're continuing to recruit people. In 166, Mattathias, the old man, dies after about a year. Judas becomes the leader and strikes with much force, the name of the Hammer or Maccabeus. Judas the Hammer or Judas Maccabeus find success even though he is untrained, unequipped. They're fighting with, you know, hoes and plow things and equipment and tools, but they're fighting a Grecian army, the Syrian, who are Grecian soldiers trained with the best facilities that you can get, or the best equipment that you can get. Judas Maccabeus takes control of villages north of Jerusalem with this procedure. Right here. He begins control from the Golan Hills. He begins to control this area, and this is how he does it. Notice how small this is. This Syrian empire extends over Babylon. And this is almost like, again, it's not like it, but it's close to like fighting Nebuchadnezzar, you know what I'm saying, and as far as territory. It's not the same, though, but it's similar. Well, he'll find an isolated Seleucid patrol. So like there's a Syrian patrol out, you know, they've got like 12, 15, 20 guys out there, and they're out doing some patrol work. They'll go out there, they'll jump them, attack them, kill them, take their weapons, and hide their bodies. And they just never come back. And so they just in here. If you were in this area here and you're on patrol as a Syrian soldier or a Seleucid soldier, it's dangerous. Coming out of nowhere is Judas Maccabeus. And he'll kill you, take your weapons, and bury you, and we'll never see you again. And so because of that, he begins to control this area. People get to join him, and he's collecting weapons. Then they wait for the search patrol, number four. Then they wait for the search patrol that would be sent out for the Seleucid garrison in Jerusalem to find them. So this patrol doesn't come back, so they send them out a search party. He attacks the search party. They attack and kill the third patrol that's sent and continue until they completely have cut off the Seleucid. And this right here, remember, there's 22,000 soldiers of the Syrians in Jerusalem. And what Judas is doing is he's building a barrier right here that they are now separated from their homeland. And they just keep killing them. They're getting fewer and fewer. And they're going to end up having to retreat into that garrison just for protection. Now, Apollonius, the Seleucid governor of Samaria. Now, we're just going to move up here. Just north, right up in here, is the Old Testament city of Samaria. They're on the side of Antiochus. This guy is not from Antiochus, Antioch. He's not from Syria. He's the governor of Samaria. And he's going to take a handful of troops. He's going to come out with 3,000 troops. It's like, we've had enough of this. And so from Samaria, he's going to be sent out with 3,000 troops. And here's how it goes. He marches out with 3,000 troops through the hills of Gophna to go help their troops trapped in Jerusalem. Help us, we can't get out. Judas has got us trapped. I'll come to your help. 3,000 troops march out to go down here and get them. Okay? Help them out. Judas sets up his troops along a narrow, winding uphill along both sides of the pass with slings, stones, and archers. With one group standing at the top to meet Apollonius, when the Seleucid forces are driven back into the bottleneck, Judas' troops on the sides rain down stones and arrows. The Seleucid troops are slaughtered. Apollonius is killed, and Judas takes the governor's sword. So in other words, there's this hill, and Judas is from this area. This is his home territory. And these guys are always playing an away game. And so he knows the territory. So he knows the best path for him to get down here to Jerusalem. And sometimes they're actually going to make very bad mistakes. And he waits for him to get this one place. He doesn't attack him here or here in an open field. He waits for him to start going through this narrow path. And he usually waits until it's uphill. And waits until they're about to the top. And then, and then it's like, oh no, now we got to fight. So he's letting the territory do the work for him. And he meets him at the top. He's got a lot of times he's got his groups, the champions was his group, his elite soldiers, at the top. And they're marching up to see him. We're going to engage him in battle. Keep coming. And they get right here. He attacks, drives them back, and his troops who are hidden in the hills above the pass, just stones and arrows. And it's just like shooting fish in a barrel is what it ends up being. And they're all slaughtered. And so now, those 22,000 have lost their support, and he wins his first major battle. Of course, this is not going to make Antiochus happened. Turn the page, 162. Because of this, this result right here, we're going to have our next one. They're going to come down this way. They're going to come down the coastal plain right here, and you can see how they cut over at a place called Lydia, coming over to Modin, coming over this way to come over to Modin to meet. So this is, again, troops have always traveled on the coastal plain, and they got to decide, eventually, you've got to decide, when are you going to turn left or turn east, and start moving into the hill country. It's like,
There's no good way to get in here. One of the things about Jerusalem that's interesting is it's not on a main road. Even the roads that go by Jerusalem go by to the west. You've got to like leave the main road and go into Jerusalem. It's not even on a main interstate. And so anyway, you can march up and down here all you want to, but eventually you've got to go east. And Judas just waits for it. Make a decision. How are you going to get to us? You've got to get into these hills. So here we go. General Sharon leads 6,000 Seleucid troops down the Mediterranean coast and then turns east towards Jerusalem through Lydia and up the steep ascent of Beth Horon. Judas chooses to meet him with his 1,200 men. So now it's 1,200 versus 6,000. The odds are always like this. Judas is eventually going to get to 10,000 soldiers by the end. He'll have 10,000 fighting with him. On a steep, narrow pass between Lower Beth Horon and Upper Beth Horon, Judas again divides his men into three groups. Two on the sides of the passes, okay, and he and his elite troops called, the champions were Alexander the Great's group, but I don't know. The faithful are his elite troop. At the head of the pass, General Sharon crosses the plain of Sharon and takes, there's a misspelling, which is like the 300th one of the book, he takes the first valley that leads to Jerusalem. This road ascends 1,500 feet in 2 miles. So a matter of 2 miles, you're marching 1,500 feet up. It's a continuous climb. And at times in a very narrow trail, so you got to go down a single file to get through. At the top of the narrow trail, Judas shows himself, like before, and his elite troops. Hey, here we are, come get us. Sharon decides he could easily drive through the few Maccabean troops. They don't even look as tough as I thought they were. Let's just go get them. But you just marched 2 miles uphill, plus you're marching into a trap. Judas to find himself trapped. Then Judas sounds the chauffeurs and the archers and slingers fire at the trapped Seleucid soldiers. Sharon is killed and the Seleucids tear off their armor, throw down their weapons, and are chased back to the coastal plain. So all they do, basically all they do is march in here to deliver the weapons, rob all their equipment, and run back to the plain. And Judas said, well, we got some more, we need some more. We got more. Right now, they will have more weapons and armor than they've got soldiers. Judas has now defeated two generals, and defeated two armies. And both of these generals, especially this last one, Sharon, has had experience in world battle campaigns. I mean, you know, battles against the Egyptians or against the Romans. He's had some world experience. And Judas, who's a priest, has just defeated him. Again, God says they'll get a little help. The surrounding nations begin to talk about the Maccabees and Judah. It now is an issue. The Maccabees' revolt has become a major rebellion against Antiochus. Because now they control this area right here. And there's still, again, the Syrian soldiers that were placed down here in the garrison are still like, what are we going to do? We're running out of food. And if this thing backfires, we're trapped. And they're going to end up just hiding in that garrison for months, waiting for help to come. Well, help is going to come. In 165, let's check the time, sorry. We'll do one more battle. Is this close enough to the Maccabean revolt? I mean,
yeah.
Okay, we're close enough. Oh. Mm-hmm. This is quite a survey, isn't it? Just kind of just sweeping through things. We're actually teaching this. Okay. Sorry. 165. The Seleucid generals, Nicanor and Gorgias, these again are very elite generals, come down the coast to kill Judas. They've got one mission. They know if we kill Judas, this whole thing will go away. And again, God works like that. God will raise up, you know, Elijah. God will raise up a David. God will raise up someone, and they become the leader. Just like we saw in the vision of Zechariah's vision with Zerubbabel and Joshua the high priest. These are the two right here. These are my anointed ones. I'm working through them, and God is working through Judas. So they've got the good plan. If we kill the anointed one, the one that God's working through, the whole thing's going to derail, but they're not going to be able to. Now, they're going to bring out 20,000 soldiers. In other words, this is getting ridiculous. And they are so confident, they're sending their best generals. And actually, there's four generals involved in this. We only mentioned two here. They're coming down with 20,000 soldiers, two of the best generals, and they're coming out of Antiochus' military. This isn't Syrian, or this isn't just a dispatch of soldiers. This is the Syrian army coming down to get Judas. This is pretty cool. They are so confident that they've already put posters up, if you call them posters, up in Antioch, up in Syria, that you're going to be able to buy, for one talent, you're going to be able to buy like 90 slaves sometime next week. So get your money ready. We'll be back with the products. And that's what there's slave masters, slave buyers and traders traveling with them, ready to just start grabbing people. They're not even thinking about getting beat. 20,000 soldiers. The Maccabeans spend the day before fasting and praying, then leave the camp at Mizpah in the night with the fire still burning. So here we go. They know, again, they are not under any illusion that, you know, hey, I think we can win this. They know that this is going to be, in fact, Judas, his sermon or his pre-game speech is recorded, is basically saying the same thing Jonathan is saying. It doesn't matter if it be by many or by few. If God wants us to win, we will win this. So he's over here at Mikvah, which is the place that Jonathan thought. It's kind of interesting. Jonathan's at the same place. The troops of the Syrians are down here at Emmaus. And they make it very obvious where their camp is at. He then at night, they have the campfires burning. And they always are playing into the Syrians' misunderstandings. The Syrians think these guys are going to be quitters or cowards. So they say, okay, well, let's act like that. So they get their campfires going, and then in the night, they leave and start marching over, I don't know exactly how they get, they come over here to the Syrian camp. But one of the detachments of soldiers has come over here to sneak attack at night Judas's camp. So when they get there, it's like, oh, they must have heard us coming and ran away. They're chickens. And so they say, well, that was easy. But actually, Judas is over here after having spent all day praying and fasting. They march at night and are waiting right over here outside. So now you've got one general over here searching through the woods, searching for Judas's troops, which he thinks are scattered in the woods, which they're not. So they're spending all night looking for soldiers that aren't there. These guys are sleeping with the slave traders being ready. They're sleeping. They've got a trench dug around their camp. They've got spears stuck in the ground. This trench with spears, so if anybody falls in, there will be a trap for them. So they're all sitting. They think they're good to go. They're sleeping. They're sound asleep. And here we go. We are on page 163. The Maccabees spend the day fasting. And the next sentence, they march 10 miles through the rough terrain to Emmaus. Now, you've heard of Emmaus before, right? On the road to Emmaus. That's the same Emmaus. There are the solutions. Have set up their own camp with 500 cavalry, the imperial troops, and the slave merchants who have already posted the price for their Jewish slaves back in Syria. The solutions have encircled their camp with a trench. General Gorgias leads his troops towards the Maccabees' camp into the night. Okay, that's what we already said, into the night, on a search and destroy mission. General Nicanor stays at the camp in Emmaus. So Nicanor is here, still in his camp, while Gorgias finds the empty camp and Mizpah figures the Maccabees have scattered. Judas feeds his troops now outside the camp of the solution. So he's outside. It's almost like Psalm 23. In the presence of my enemies, he prepares the table before me. And they're sitting right here. These guys are looking for him. These guys are thinking they're being defeated over here, waiting to sell them as slaves. And Judas is outside their camp, and they're eating, having a little picnic. They're getting ready to attack. So in other words, you can just see how he's just off sync with what they're expecting. Judas feeds his troops outside the camp and the solutions and moves into the battle lines to attack General Nicanor, who thought Judas was being attacked at Mizpah. Well, what are you doing here? Aren't you being attacked? No, we're not being attacked. We're here to attack you. Well, what is the other general doing? We're not sure. I think he's looking for us. When the sun rises, the Maccabees can be seen stationed on a high ground above the solution camp. So they've been waiting for the sun. As the sun comes up, they look. It's like, uh-oh. We're under attack. They're waiting to attack us. And they did not. They thought Judas might be dead by now. But instead, they're on like one of those Wild West movies, you know, when the Indians come up on the horizon, it's like, oh no, circle the wagon. That's what they've got right here, circle the wagon. The Canis troops, I'll have to go back to them. Judas leads the charge down. And this is one thing I admire about guys like David and Judas. They're not sitting up on the hill going, go this way, more troops over here. They're like Alexander, they're in the front leading the charge down the hill. It's like, I don't follow him. He leads the charge down towards the camp of Nicanor and shatters their disciplined ranks. They're all lined up. He just plows right into them. One of the things that he's got that he does here is he fights. I mean, they're like martyrs. I don't want to say suicide bombers. That'd be blasphemous. But they're in the sense of like, if we don't fight, we're going to get killed anyhow. They're destroying our culture. We're just going to go down. And so he's fighting heads over heels. He's going straight down. And they're like, well, this isn't a good strategy. He's just running right at us. And he gets in the middle and just shatters their organized ranks.
and pushes them back into the spike trenches that they'd set up. They weren't expecting this. Nicanor's troops flee. Judas burns their camp. Okay, so right here, these guys are still up here looking. The Nicanor here, his troops, they're falling the trenches. Judas has just split the ring. They start running back to the coast again. Nicanor's troops flee. Judas burns their camp, sets it on fire. 3,000 Syrians are killed in the next 6 miles. Judas reassembles his troops back at the Emmaus camp. Back here, they get all organized. And notice right here, very disciplined. They pull themselves together in this camp. And he forbids any looting and waits for General Gorgias to return. Now realize, they've got all the gold and silver of the slave masters who took off. Everything is there, you know, all their eye touches, iPods, everything is just left laying there. He just says, don't touch anything, because we've got one more battle to fight. And so now about Gorgias, who's been up looking all night long, marching all night, we can't find him. Let's go back and find out what the cannon knows what to do. Marching back to their camp, which is on fire. Judas reassembles his troops back in Emmaus, forbids looting. When Gorgias, tired and hungry men, return to see the organized Maccabees, they also fled. They see their camp being burnt. They see it's under the Maccabees having to go, we're hungry, we're tired, we've been looking for you all night, we found you in our camp. They said, this kid's just get out of here, these guys are spooky. In the Seleucid camp, the Jews found treasure chests full of gold and silver from slave traders, and in enough armor and weapons for the Maccabean forces. Judas celebrates, and Judas' numbers grow to 10,000. The Hellenistic Jews in Jerusalem fled to the Acra because they realized, remember, in Jerusalem, now realize, in Jerusalem, there are Jews who are cheering for the Syrians. And when they see this, they go, let us into the Acra, let us into the fortress. And so now the 22,000 troops that were staged here open the doors, and the Jews come in and say, we are in trouble because this is not our side. Our political party is losing. So again, realize the Jews themselves are very divided. And we're going to leave that right there on page 160, or year 165. And we've got one of the greatest battles coming, and it will be the last one as far as before Judas actually regains Jerusalem. And that is when they send down a huge amount of troops to try and defeat Judas. And now Judas has got, you know, some 10,000. 65,000 versus 10,000 troops in this next battle. Now just see what Judas said. And we're just talking a matter of months. From Mattathias and his five sons are now got 10,000 troops, and they're about to face 65,000 Syrian soldiers, and they can't be stopped. I mean, it's hard to find a greater story in history than a bunch of nobodies fighting against a type of the Antichrist and getting to this level. So again, we got some more things to take place here. I appreciate your patience. With a little bit that I've said here tonight, if you go and find a book or something and read through the details, a lot of this stuff will just come up. If nothing else, read 1st and 2nd Maccabees. Get an apocryphon, read 1st and 2nd Maccabees. I know I'm not trying to make you Catholic. Yeah, you can find it on, or just type in 1st Maccabees. And there's a place online you can find. But yeah, it's there. And but anyway, hey, I'll pray and let you go. Thank you so much for being patient. Father, we do thank you for your truth. We thank you for the chance to look at history. We do ask that we find direction and guidance from this, and we thank you for the encouragement we can see in the lives of other believers. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you again so much.
Yes.